Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Elise Anders will be on to fill us in on the anti-vaccination phenomenon that surrounds the hostility to the HPV vaccine. Dr. Carhart's landlord decides to fight back against anti-choice protesters, and a new campaign highlights the voice of women who have had abortions. I'm happy to note that Jessica Valente's documentary of her book, The Purity Myth, is coming out, and here's the audio from the trailer.
Jessica, you call it a myth, a purity myth.
What do you mean?
The purity myth is the lie that women's sexuality has some bearing on who we are and how good we are. Because really, I think that we all know that young women are so much more than whether or not they have sex.
I am living my life the way that I think should be lived, and that's staying pure. So
you really believe in no sex before marriage?
No, I don't at all.
You can only be the promiscuous girls gone wild or the chaste virgin, when really most women live their lives in kind of this middle ground, and we need to have a room for a more complex conversation about sexuality that doesn't have this double standard for women.
If anything, Jessica's thoughts on this are more important now than ever, as the hostility towards young women's sexuality grows through anti-contraception and anti-HPV vaccine campaigns. One of the most distressing constants in the fight over women's reproductive rights is the presence of harassment and terrorist tactics from the anti-choice movement. Anti-choicers call it protesting, but it doesn't resemble what most people think of protesting, where public people and institutions are challenged in public ways to encourage public dialogue about public policy. No, anti-choicers get a rise out of targeting private citizens about private business. The more private, the better. I personally think that there's a lascivious side to it, that is, they really enjoy seeking out women getting abortions so they can shame them for being sexual beings. Some anti-choicers put women's pictures on their sites with black bars over their eyes, as if they were in pornographic pictures or something. But it's indisputable that they get off on the bullying and intimidation. This was evidenced by recent events where anti-choicers decided to target a junior high school girl for abuse because her father owns the building that abortion provider Dr. Leroy Carhart works out of.
On back to school night at a Maryland middle school, protesters stationed themselves outside the middle school carrying graphic, bloody anti-abortion signs. The protesters were at that particular middle school because the father of a student there owns the property where Dr. Leroy Carhart works. Dr. Carhart is a late-term abortion provider who is the nationally demonized doctor du jour for the anti-abortion movement. So to protest Dr. Carhart, the protesters picketed the school attended by the child of the owner of the property where the doctor practices.
It's important to remember that children are being targeted in an atmosphere of violence. Anti-choicers know this, and I suspect relish it. The message here is, nice daughter you've got there. Shame if something happened to her. Antis will deny this, but the message comes through loud and clear to the people targeted. You don't really bust out the I know where you live, where you work, where your kids go to school, and don't forget what happened to the last doctor that Dr. Carhart worked with technique without it being a threat. This isn't protesting. The FBI defines terrorism as the use of violence or threatened violence to intimidate not just the government, but a civilian population for political ends. Anti-choicers skirt this definition by not directly threatening violence, but as anyone with two brain cells can figure out, the I know where your children go to school thing, coupled with the violent history of the anti-choice movement, is quite threatening. The reason anti-choicers use the implied threat of violence is that it works. As Dr. Means in Kansas has discovered, no landlord is willing to put their families in danger from violent anti-choicers by renting to her. But Dr. Carhart's landlord, Todd Stave, will not be intimidated. Instead, he's fighting back.
Here's something, he told them. Mr. Stave started taking down the names and phone numbers of the people who called him to protest his decision to lease space to Dr. Carhart's clinic. When people asked how they could help him, he asked those volunteers to call the people back who had been calling him, to thank them for their thoughts and to tell them that no, he would not be shutting Dr. Carhart down. He couldn't legally, even if he wanted to, and besides, he didn't want to. He supports women's rights.
The tactic worked well enough that they're formalizing it by starting an organization called Voice of Choice. You can go to vochoice.org and volunteer. Basically, you would be called upon to call and email people who contact abortion providers who are being harassed. Since they feel that addressing people in their private lives is acceptable political discourse, they clearly feel that this is okay. I wouldn't recommend calling people who are unwilling to target private individuals, of course, but every person on the list that they have has made it clear that that's acceptable because they target private individuals going about their private business. Be polite. The people you're calling claim to believe these calls are protests, so please make it clear you are merely protesting their behavior with techniques they themselves have signed off on. Refrain, please, from going where they go, which is the I know where you live crap. That's a threat, and we don't want to play dirty like they do. Todd Stave came on to Maddow's show to explain why he's sticking to his guns even though anti-choicers have shown a willingness to target his family.
I've actually been a victim of this sort of thing for my entire life. My father was an abortion provider, and I remember when I was a junior in high school back in the early 80s, my father's clinic was firebombed. So I've been around this sort of thing for my entire life, and I've sat very quietly while people around me, people in the middle of the argument, have done whatever it is they do or not do whatever it is they do. And up until, and I just found this out this week, up until recently, nobody has ever really done anything to counter-protest or counter-respond or fight back. Their philosophy has always been, well, if we ignore them, they'll go away. And they just picked on the wrong guy this time. I mean, I am not doing anything except renting space to this clinic. And to go in front of my daughter's middle school and attempt to humiliate me and an attempt to humiliate my daughter, I needed to fight back.
It's incredibly shameful the way our society simply accepts that anti-choicers will occasionally commit acts of violence, and then thousands of harassers will build on that violence to scare and intimidate people who are trying to help others make private legal choices about their private lives.
I'd like to welcome Elise Anders to the program. I've been doing a lot of coverage of the HPV vaccine and the opposition to it lately, and I realized it would be good to get some more info about the larger controversy over vaccines on the show. And who better to ask than Elise? Elise writes for Skeptic and has taken up pro-vaccination activism as her cause, and she's here to share her expertise on the subject with us. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Elise.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So I mostly cover the HPV vaccine on this show and from the angle of conservatives opposing it because they believe it promotes sexual activity. But it's being fed, the paranoia is being fed, by a larger anti-vaccination movement that has nothing to do with sex. Can you talk a little about the history of this modern anti-vaccination movement?
The anti-vaccine movement itself has been around as long as vaccines have been around. But in the last, you know, decade or so, it's kind of taken on a whole new life. Andrew Wakefield did some research in the late 90s that supposedly showed that the MMR was linked to autism, and that study, which was published in The Lancet, was retracted from The Lancet. It was basically a completely fraudulent study. And then from that, we also had Jenny McCarthy, who decided that her son became autistic from receiving the MMR vaccine. And then Jenny McCarthy went on Oprah, and it took off from there, and Jenny McCarthy being the spokesperson for anti-vaccine has been been a really bad thing, because the movement has taken off and people are now actually opting out of vaccinating their children because they're afraid of things like autism, and now people are dying of things like the measles, which was actually eradicated in the United States about a decade ago. So that's kind of a short story.
Well, it's interesting to me because it seems like it started off with just the MMR, really, and now it seems to have just sort of exploded into just paranoia about vaccination in general.
Well, the interesting thing is that the MMR vaccine, you know, was where this panic sort of started. And then the panic also went on to an ingredient called thimerosal, which is a preservative it's not really in any vaccines right now, just your flu vaccine. But they took thimerosal out of vaccines because thimerosal was thought to maybe be causing autism. But thimerosal was never in the MMR vaccine. So it's really interesting to see how these things have kind of evolved and what happens and their arguments. So, you know, it was MMR and then it was thimerosal, and then like now it's anything that's in a vaccine, basically.
And it's interesting to me because, again, all the coverage I've been doing on this program has been about right-wing opposition to one specific vaccine, but the larger anti-vaccination movement is not a right-wing phenomenon at all.
No, it's not. It's right, and I wouldn't even say that it's typically any, you know, at any point in the political spectrum. It's found, you know, there's Tea Party, there's that are anti-vax, and there's far left people that are anti-vax. And at this point, it's really the fear of vaccine, even if people aren't necessarily anti-vaccine, the fear of vaccine is just, it's rampant. I mean, everybody seems to be a little bit afraid of vaccines right now.
And do you think there are some vaccines that generate more suspicions and fears than others?
You know, we're actually doing some research into this right now, and our sort of preliminary findings are that everybody's kind of afraid of vaccines in general. Most people still think that vaccines are worth doing. And what we're finding is that people will do whatever is required, and then they opt out of anything that's not required. So they'll get their vaccines for school, and they may do those on a different schedule. Some people like to spread out their vaccines, which doesn't make sense because then your kid's just getting more shots, but just over a longer period of time. And then they're exposed to those diseases while they're susceptible to those diseases while they haven't been vaccinated. But then they don't get things like the chickenpox vaccine or, you know, like you've been talking about, the HPV vaccine. So if they're not required, people, and this isn't even like, you know, anti-vax, people are generally just, oh, well, if we don't need it, we're not going to get that vaccine. Our kids get enough vaccines, which is scary to me.
That's interesting to me because I've seen the research showing that the compliance rate for the HPV vaccine is really low, or the uptake rate, I guess, because it's not mandated in most places. I was assuming that it was because people have sexual paranoias, but it seems like it also could just be this issue too.
I think the HPV has the added sort of, oh my God, they're going to have sex if we give them this shot that'll prevent them from getting cervical cancer, because they don't have anything else to worry about with sex, I guess. But nothing else can go wrong after cervical cancer is solved. But there is that too. So I've talked to people who would get the chicken pox vaccine, but think that the HPV vaccine is inappropriate because it's dirty and sex, which it's so bizarre to me because, you know, I don't know anybody who, as a kid, got a shot and they're like, hey, Mom, what was that for? You get your shots and they're awful and you hate them, but, you know, you don't ask a lot of questions. And you're like, oh, well, can I just go and have sex with anybody then? Because that's what I do when I'm 11.
So I don't want to make you speculate too much, but beyond just sort of the general fear that's been spread, what do you think kind of motivates people to be so afraid of vaccines?
I think that's a really complicated question. I think there's a lot of things involved. I think vaccines in general are scary. You know, like I said, when you're a kid, they're awful. They're needles and it's things being injected into your skin. And that's scary. I mean, most people are not fond of getting shots in the first place. And then we have these people talking about chemicals. There's these chemicals in the vaccines. And right now we have this thing that chemicals are bad and natural is good. And that's one of the arguments that the anti-vaccine movement likes to make, is that if you get the disease, then you have a natural immunity to the disease, as opposed to putting these chemicals into your body, which are in the vaccine, which again is sort of unfounded, because, you know, if you get the disease, you risk dying or passing it on to somebody else who could die or have complications, or, you know, I mean, that means that you're very sick. Your body has a natural response to the vaccine when it's injected into your body. And it's the same response that you would have if you got the disease. You don't have to get the disease. And the whole thing is just...
It's a little bit something for nothing.
Yeah, and then the idea of these scary chemicals... One of the new big ones right now is aluminum. And, you know, we don't know how much aluminum is in a vaccine. And what if this is what's causing autism, is the aluminum. And there's more aluminum in breast milk than there is in a vaccine. So if you're going to breastfeed, your child's going to be, you know, exposed to aluminum anyway. So I think there's a lot of things that are just scary about vaccines in general, and then we've added this media paranoia on top of it.
You've done a lot of activism to promote vaccination. Can you share some of your successes so that we kind of end on a hopeful note?
Yeah, you know, we've had a few pushes to get... there have been some anti-vaccine advertisements that have been paid for by a few of the anti-vaccine organizations. The National Vaccination Information Center and Mercola and Safe Minds and, you know, Age of Autism. They were running advertisements in AMC theaters over Thanksgiving weekend last year. And we ended up doing a petition on change.org and asking people to sign it. And, you know, thousands of people signed the petition. It was a Sunday morning. And by Sunday afternoon, AMC agreed to never run an anti-vaccination ad in their theaters. We had awesome. A little bit less of success with, there was an ad in Times Square last spring. One of the problems was that the ad was already running, and it's a lot harder to get an ad pulled once it's already running. But it was being run in Times Square, and we tried to get it pulled, but there was no response from CBS Outdoor, who had the Jumbotron with the ad on it. But we got a lot of people involved, and the cause got the American Academy of Pediatrics coming out and condemning the ad. And it was, you know, we didn't get the ad pulled, but we got a lot of people talking about why the ad was bad and, you know, vaccines aren't really something to be afraid of. And lately, I think that Michelle Bachmann's strange statements have done a lot of good, because now people are talking about why she's so wrong. So we're not doomed. We're not all going to die of measles, hopefully.
Well, my guest today has been Elise Anders. You can follow her writing on skepchick.org, where she is joined by many other awesome skeptical ladies and one gentleman. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Elise.
Thanks for having me, Amanda.
So I'm thrilled to announce that Advocates for Youth, Choice USA, and Spiritual Youth for Reproductive Freedom have released a joint project called the 1 in 3 campaign. The name, as I'm sure some of you have figured out, is a reference to the fact that 1 in 3 women will have an abortion in her lifetime at current rates. The idea is a simple one that goes back to the days of early pro-choice activism, but it's also the most powerful weapon we have in our arsenal: women's stories. Anti-choice opinions form in the void of women's silence about abortion. It's easy for people to buy anti-choice stereotypes that women who have abortions are dirty sluts or emotionally broken train wrecks. What this series does is put a very human face on women who have abortions.
Let's see, I was 23 and I had just finished undergrad, and I moved to San Diego just on my way. I was going to be teaching English in Korea, so I was there working for the summer, and I was in a relationship. Taking birth control pills not consistently or correctly. I didn't really have a lot of education on how I was supposed to be taking them. And I was in a sexual relationship and I ended up getting pregnant. And for me, it was never really a question of what my decision was going to be. I just needed, you know, the resources to be able to do that.
They've got the section divided into pre- and post-Roe stories. The pre-Roe stories are hard to take, as you can imagine. Extremely horrific stuff went down when abortion was illegal. One woman tells a story of a friend who was blindfolded, taken to the clinic and operated on with no drugs at all, and then dumped in pain and bleeding on a street corner far away from where she had been picked up. One woman describes an abortion technique involving packing gauze onto the cervix and drinking turpentine. And one woman who was training as a nurse during the 60s told this story.
I was 21. She was just a year older than I was. She was a law student. She had a whole future ahead of her. She had a steady boyfriend. And yet being pregnant to her was not what she wanted for herself at that moment. And so in trying to abort the pregnancy herself, she punctured her uterus, and because of the bleeding, her uterus had to be removed, and what it meant was that she no longer would be able to have children. And thinking to myself, this shouldn't happen. What's wrong here? What can we do so that this doesn't happen to other young women?
Self-abortion was the main cause of septic abortions before Roe, because even the seedy underground abortion providers at least knew what they were doing, mostly. And a lot of underground abortion providers were professionals. Should abortion become illegal again, we likely wouldn't have an underground network of providers, especially since anti-choicers will likely demand outrageous criminal penalties for it. So we'd probably see an even higher percentage of women who seek abortions doing things like sticking coat hangers in their uteruses and puncturing them. But what I want to do is contrast this nurse's recollection of the 60s with this woman's description of her abortion in what seems to be the past decade.
My experience was going in to a doctor's office and having a medical procedure done. And I think what happens a lot of times is that people kind of pull them apart. Like, having an abortion is this, you go to some little clinic somewhere in some alley or somewhere and have this done, but this was really a better experience than when I went to the doctor to find out why my stomach was hurting. So abortion is medical care, and it was really a great experience for me. Wonderful, compassionate doctors.
One of the reasons stories are so important is that the debate gets so abstract. Anti-choicers prefer to talk about banning abortion in the most non-specific terms possible. They just simply like to assume that it means it goes away and they never have to think about it ever again. But in reality, the real issue here is access to safe abortion. Without legal abortion, that becomes fraught, as these women's stories demonstrate. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Predictable Sexism Edition. Elizabeth Warren is outspoken. Elizabeth Warren is running for Senate in Massachusetts and will almost surely unseat the Tea Party candidate that got Ted Kennedy's seat in the wake of his demise. Elizabeth Warren, therefore, must be subject to a barrage of pointless sexism.
The Democrat seat to run against Scott Brown, and she's on her talking tour. She's going to people's homes in Massachusetts. And this is the babe that was the former chair of the TARP panel.
Besides calling her a babe, Limbaugh also whined that Warren has held a lot of different jobs and got paid for those jobs. Since he's a multimillionaire fat cat, one has to wonder why he thinks it's scandalous for Warren to work and draw a salary for her work. Just kidding. He knows that women who make their own money is a big red hot button for his audience.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.